Good morning. It's Thursday, July 31st. I'm Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, what to know as we hit Trump's tariff deadline, how mass starvation in Gaza could impact Palestinians for generations, and why that huge earthquake off Russia's coast wasn't as bad as so many feared. But first, to an issue almost all Americans agree is a problem, even in these divided times, affordable housing. There are 4.5 million too few homes right now, according to the Chamber of Congress. The median age for a first-time home purchase is nearly 40, by some estimates. And about half of people renting are cost-burdened, meaning more than 30% of their income is spent on rent. Lawmakers in Congress agree something needs to change. And now there's an unlikely bipartisan alliance forming around a bill to address the shortage that's gaining momentum.
A sort of unusual thing happened in the Senate, which is that a major piece of legislation passed a committee unanimously.
That's Liz Goodwin, who covers Congress for The Washington Post. She told us about how two senators on the Banking Committee, Republican Tim Scott and Democrat Elizabeth Warren, came together to write this measure.
She's the highest-ranking Democrat on the committee, and he runs the committee, and kind of said, you know, can we agree on anything? And they basically found that they both agreed that the housing crisis is really bad and that the solution to it is just to build more houses.
And this bill tries to do that primarily through deregulation, which appeals to both Republicans who are eager to cut red tape and Democrats who also think regulations have gone too far and are holding back the housing market. It proposes things like loosening the rules to build prefab or factory-made homes, tax incentives for development in poorer areas, and a $1 billion innovation fund.
If a local government does a good job building housing, they get more money. So there's sort of a carrot and stick situation here where they're trying to incentivize places to build more affordable housing.
And while the national conversation about housing affordability often centers around urban areas where rents are so high, this bill is pretty broad.
There's a lot in this bill that deals with rural housing because a lot of the members of this committee are from rural states. A lot of times these housing bills are more geared towards like urban issues, and this is not one of them. It's people really stacked it with all of their different priorities.
Goodwin says the bill wouldn't make dramatic changes to anyone's neighborhood anytime soon or create new zones for housing. Housing advocates say the legislation won't fully make up for recent moves to cut housing programs for lower-income Americans or make up for the recent substantial cuts to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And many of the barriers to housing are state-led initiatives, not easily changed by Congress. Still, the bill itself has a good chance of making it to the floor, with Senate Majority Leader John Thune acknowledging its unusually strong support. But now that the Senate is about to take a break, the earliest it could reach a vote would be in September. Now to President Trump's tariff deadline. He's given nearly 180 countries until tomorrow to reach trade agreements with the United States or else face steep tariff hikes. Remember, he announced these tariffs back in April, but paused most of them after they triggered a massive sell-off in global markets, wiping out trillions of dollars in value from the U.S. stock market alone. Wall Street has since recovered and hit record highs, and Trump's administration has spent the last few months trying to negotiate deals. He's announced 8 so far, with the EU, Japan, the Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, the UK, South Korea, and Pakistan. He has touted them as major victories, but Politico points out only one of these agreements has been signed, which means most are not really official yet. It's not clear how much they might benefit the U.S., and the terms could still change.
The devil is in the details, and these details can really affect how impactful some of these wins that President Trump has claimed in these deals are.
That's Daniel DeRocher, international trade reporter with Politico.
It's very much like the president says, I made this great deal. Here's what they're going to do. And then the other countries will say, well, you know, yes, kind of.
Take the framework agreement with the EU Trump announced last weekend, for example, which would put a 15% tariff on almost all imports from the 27 member nations.
He said that the EU is going to eliminate all tariffs on U.S. goods that are sent over there. And the president of the European Commission then later clarified, well, no, it's not all goods. You know, it's some things. And some of those things still need to be ironed out, you know, specifically agricultural product. That means that we don't really know where the tariffs are going to be on, say, wine from Italy or France, or whether or not bourbon will be tariffed when it goes over there.
The White House has released very few details on its recent agreement with the Philippines. Indonesia is disputing some of the details released on theirs. DeRosha reports that it's not clear if Japan can guarantee the private sector investments in the U.S. that they've promised. They, too, seem to have different interpretations of the deal that Trump announced. And Vietnam has not confirmed the U.S. tariff rate that Trump says it agreed to. As for the deal just made with South Korea, the U.S. will charge a 15% tariff on imports, and Trump has said they had agreed to invest in U.S. projects. As with many of the others, journalists have not been able to analyze any detailed text. DeRosher tells us even the UK's deal, that's the one that's been formally signed, is murky on the details. The UK is still pressing for the US to make good on its commitment to eliminate tariffs on steel and aluminum. And the two countries are still haggling over restrictions on agricultural goods and other key sectors. With so little information on what's happening with these tariffs, DeRosher says businesses are suffering.
Because even if you have a handshake agreement, say that even gets put down on paper, but the U.S. is still maintaining that they have the right to raise tariffs whenever they want. And that just creates this environment of uncertainty. Businesses don't really know how high the tariffs are, how high they're going to end up. They're trying to make these bets and hedge of like, okay, is this the lowest rate that we're going to have? And so it's making the business scene really, really complicated. It's making the investment scene really, really complicated.
The White House has said it stands by their descriptions of the deals announced, and it's threatened to raise tariffs on countries that don't follow those terms. Let's turn now to Gaza. And before we go further, a warning that this story contains graphic descriptions of people suffering from hunger. Local health officials say the Palestinian death toll from Israel's military offensive has surpassed 60,000 people, although experts widely agree that the true total is higher. Authorities say thousands of bodies are still buried under rubble. And the world's leading monitor of hunger called on Israel and other governments this week to take immediate action to secure a sustained unconditional ceasefire and facilitate a large-scale humanitarian response for starving Palestinians. This latest report from the UN-affiliated IPC, which is short for the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, concluded that Israel's blockade on aid has created famine conditions across most of the enclave and caused catastrophic human suffering. The report confirms what people inside Gaza and worldwide have been seeing with their own eyes in recent months, largely thanks to local journalists and aid workers who are working to document the crisis despite starving themselves. Here's how Salma Altawil, who works in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council, described conditions for the BBC.
I'm not able to help myself or feed my children. I'm talking about starvation that is not a specific area or for a group of people. It covers all, everything in Gaza, humans, animals.
We've seen images of mothers holding emaciated children, babies in pediatric wards that appear skeletal and barely have the energy to cry. The AP recently told the story of a 5-month-old girl who died weighing roughly 1/3 less than her birth weight. The IPC report says hospitals have seen a rapid increase in hunger-related deaths of children under 5 in the last 3 months. Over 20,000 children have been admitted for acute malnutrition in that time. NPR spoke with Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah, who leads the pediatric ward at Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza. He says because Gaza's youngest have been so nutritionally deprived during a critical phase of development for their nervous systems, many could grow up with neurological impairments.
Like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, difficulty in school performance, in comprehension, speaking.
When a child is malnourished, the damage can quite literally change how their genes function, impacting families for generations to come. Earlier this week, Israel said that it would open up some aid corridors and begin airdropping limited amounts of food. But Hani Al-Madoun from the UN's Palestinian Humanitarian Group told CBS News Israel still is not letting enough aid in.
We are excited to hear about the news about aid being allowed into Gaza. But remember, the Palestinians cannot eat announcements. We need to go back to 500 to 600 trucks of aid. So far, this has not happened.
Some countries are starting to put more pressure on Israel. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced the country will recognize Palestine as a state by September if Israel refuses to announce a ceasefire, among other terms. Canada says it will do the same, and France made a similar announcement last week. Before we let you go, a few other stories we're following. The Federal Reserve voted to hold interest rates steady between 4.25 and 4.5% for the fifth consecutive time. But for the first time in more than 30 years, the vote saw dissent from two officials on the board. Trump appointees Michelle Bowman and Christopher Waller both voted to lower rates, in line with the wishes of President Trump, who's put intense pressure on the committee. The Hill reports both are in the running for Trump's pick for the next Fed chair. But the current chair, Jerome Powell, played down the significance of their dissent and said they laid out a clear case for their decisions. After one of the strongest earthquakes in modern history hit Russia yesterday, the massive tsunami that many feared would materialize ultimately didn't come. Scientific American spoke with experts about the geological reasons for that, and they say the magnitude of an earthquake alone cannot necessarily tell you how much water will be displaced or where waves will concentrate. Tsunamis can be affected by the shape and nature of the coastline and seafloor they pass over, and more generally, the way we measure earthquakes is not linear. A small increase in magnitude causes a huge jump in energy unleashed, which could explain why Tuesday's 8.8 magnitude quake was far less catastrophic than the 9.1 magnitude earthquake that struck Japan in 2011, killing over 15,000 people. And finally, Beyoncé made history as the first Black woman to top the Billboard country charts. Now her Cowboy Carter tour is officially the highest-grossing country tour of all time. The tour earned just over $400 million after 32 stops, 1.6 million tickets sold, and one pretty memorable flying car mishap. She created this record after getting snubbed by the country music industry almost a decade ago, with the goal of highlighting the long-ignored contributions Black Americans have made to the genre. And this latest accolade joins a long list of records. Beyoncé was the first Black artist to win Country Album of the Year at the Grammys for Cowboy Carter. And Live Nation says she is now the highest-grossing Black artist of all time. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. For years, thousands of North Koreans secretly worked remote jobs for hundreds of U.S. companies under false identities, and they funneled millions of dollars back to North Korea, which is under heavy U.S. sanctions. An Arizona woman who helped them was recently sentenced to more than 8 years in prison for her role in the scheme, and she shared her story with Bloomberg Businessweek. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story, and I'll be back with the news tomorrow.